This is 9/11 Freefall.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of 9/11 Freefall. My name is Andy Steele, and I am the host. Tonight, we're going to be joined by Richard Gage, AIA, and James Corbett of the Corbett Report. They're both going to be presenting at the Red Pill Expo in Bozeman, Montana at the end of this month. We're going to have more details about that event. A lot of great speakers lined up there. Richard Gage will be getting into that during this interview. And, of course, we're going to have the opportunity to talk to James Corbett and get his insight on the topic that we always talk about, 9/11, controlled demolitions of the three towers in New York on that day. Other issues come up in this interview, too. I know this is going to be one that our supporters are going to want to hear. You're not going to want to miss it. So don't go anywhere. I'll be bringing that to you in just a few moments.
The views expressed on this show by guests and the host on issues outside of the 9/11 controlled demolition evidence are the opinions of those individuals alone and do not necessarily reflect those of architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth.
All right, I'm joined by two people who have been hard at work for a very long time bringing information and education to the general public about very important events, in particular the truth about what really happened on September 11th, 2001. First, we're going to start with James Corbett. He's been living and working in Japan since 2004. He started the Corbett Report website back in 2007. As an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. Since then, he's written and recorded and edited thousands of hours of audio and video media for the website. It's CorbettReport.com, and including a podcast and several regular online video series. I see his videos all over the place. Typically, people, when they want to inform me of some general information, they don't send me mainstream media sources. They send me what James Corbett put out. He produces video reports for GRTV and is the lead editorial writer for the International Forecaster, the weekly e-newsletter created by the late Bob Chapman. We're going to be getting to know more about James Corbett here on 9/11 Freefall in just a few minutes. He's joined today by Richard Gage, AIA. Richard is a San Francisco Bay Area architect of 30 years, a member of the American Institute of Architects, and he's the founder and CEO of a little group called Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. We talk about this organization all the time here on this show. It's the reason the show exists, to get the word out about the scientific evidence proving that the three towers in New York were brought down in controlled demolitions that day. And both of these gentlemen are going to be speaking at the Red Pill Expo in Bozeman, Montana, which is on June 23rd and the 24th. We're going to spend a little bit of time talking about that here in the beginning of the interview. But first, I just want to welcome you guys to 9/11 Freefall.
Thank you, Andy.
And thank you very much for having me on. It's good to be here.
So, Richard, we're going to start with you. What is the Red Pill Expo? Give us all the details that you have.
Well, this is one of the most exciting conferences that the 9/11 Truth movement has had in a long time. I mean, James and I are one of several very high profile speakers in this event in Bozeman, Montana, in the heart of the Rocky Mountains, also the heart of conservative or even libertarian patriots, all kind of hold the heart of the patriot or truth movement, if you will, in the Pacific Northwest. So it's very exciting to be a part of this. G. Edward Griffin has coordinated this along with Dan Happel, who puts together the radio show, and they are promoting it heavily already. Of the 500 seats that are available, they've pre-sold more than half of them, which is a great sign. So I'm looking forward to scooting out there and meeting all of these speakers, including the rich dad, poor dad, Robert Kiyosaki. He's a very famous guy, and I'm looking forward to seeing what he has to say. The new economy, you know, how you get ahead in today's world economically. But I'm guessing, and I don't know this, that since G. Edward Griffin has brought him to this group of truth bearers, that he also has something to tell in the way of truths that are uncomfortable or inconvenient for most of America, as do the other speakers, James Corbett and myself notwithstanding. But Mike Adams will be there from the Health Ranger, consumer health advocate, an investigative journalist, a founder and editor of naturalnews.com, very popular website speaking the truth. Lord Christopher Monckton, who has from the British press and in government and a press officer with the Conservative Central Office, he has exposed the climate change, as he calls it, a scam. And I know that's very controversial, but that's kind of his position on it. And I'm sure that's what he'll be talking about. Of course, G. Edward Griffin himself will be looking at the Federal Reserve System, which is, as he says, neither federal nor a reserve. It's no more of a government issue. It's a banking cartel, basically, that's running our banking system and economy. And also, he's done a lot of work on cancer and cures. So he'll be speaking about that. Ty Bollinger, Patrick Wood, Joe Salatin. He calls himself the Christian libertarian environmentalist capitalist lunatic farmer. They call him the most famous farmer in the world, the high priest of pasture, and the most eclectic thinker from Virginia since Thomas Jefferson. How about that? Dan Johnson, also for the Tax Revolution Institute. So, of course, we'll be talking about the tax system in America and how much sense it makes or not. John B. Wells of the Caravan to Midnight show, a very famous show exposing lots of lies and false flags and so forth. Cynthia McKinney will be there as well, famous in the truth movement, a former congressman from Alabama. Alex Newman, international journalist. Holly Swanson, the writer and political activist, hidden agenda of the environmentalist movement. And James Corbett. Oh, my God, James is going to be there. Well, James is with us tonight, of course. Richard Gage will be there. Jeff Barwick, the dollar vigilante. John Rappaport, or Rappaport. I don't know if that T is silent or not, but he is an investigative reporter who is anything other than silent. He speaks it as it is. And there's many, many more. So it's going to be very exciting. Andy, I'm really looking forward to being a part of this.
Well, it sounds like a Mount Rushmore of the alternative news movement, whatever you call it, of people that I've been watching on the internet for a number of years, ever since I came across this information back in 2006. So I know that this is something I would like to see. I don't know if I can get out to Montana or not, but if you are in the area, if you are able to physically go to this, I highly recommend that you take the drive out, take the plane out if you can, get your tickets to it. The website is redpillexpo.org. That's where you're going to find the details on how you can attend on June 23rd and the 24th. They've got an entire itinerary listed here. Be able to listen to the people, like I said, that you've been watching on the internet for years, talking about some really important issues, 9/11 and other things. And we're going to be talking a little bit more about yourself in just a moment, James, but when you go to this, or when you do your video for the event, just a little preview, what do you want to talk about down there? What do you hope that people get out of your presentation?
Yes, I should stress up front, because there may be some confusion, I am not physically going to be in Bozeman, Montana for this conference, unfortunately. I'd love to be able to be there, but just schedules and travel and all that being what it is, I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to be there in person. So I will be appearing via video presentation that I'm preparing specially for the event. And it's interesting that, of course, this event, as Richard mentioned there, is being organized by G. Edward Griffin, perhaps most famous for The Creature from Jekyll Island, his look at the Federal Reserve System and the central bank and monetary system in the United States generally. And at around the time when he first contacted me about this conference, I was dusting off an essay that I've had kicking around for a few years on the subject of the Federal Reserve, the central banking system, monetary reform, and with a sort of matrix type of analogy built into it. And so G. Edward Griffin contacting me about the Red Pill Expo, it just all kind of came together and seemed rather fortuitous. So I will be talking generally about that theme, the idea of what central banking is, what the monetary system that we're living in is, and why it needs to be changed. And more fundamentally, I think it's about the psychology of the way that we take this system so much for granted that we don't even think to question it. And I think that is the starting point for so many of these things, 9/11 and other things, that people have just heard the same story from every official source for so long that they don't even think that there is any genuine need to question that. And that's what I want people thinking along the lines of when they hear my speech about monetary reform.
You know, The Matrix is such a good analogy. That movie, I remember when I saw it back in 2000, probably 2000, before 9/11, definitely. To me, that was just a movie with Keanu Reeves in a trench coat back then. But now you start to see what they're trying to tell you in that movie. And essentially, you know, what it's like to wake up to bigger issues, issues that, you know, you would have never thought twice about before. I remember before I started waking up to 9/11, the thought that there could be anything else to it just seemed so ludicrous to me. We were always taught not to listen to those people. We had names for them. We were taught to dismiss them until you, by accident, happen to see Building 7 falling late at night on YouTube, and a guy saying, hey, this isn't natural, and what's scary is that you actually agree with him. You see this and you say, there's no way fire could have done this to that building. So you end up going down the rabbit hole. You learn about 9/11. You learn about other things. So you're going to be seeing a lot of these speakers talking about that. You're going to have an opportunity to hear some great minds at this event. Again, it's redpillexpo.org. There's a schedule there. There's details on how you can sign up. Definitely check it out if you are in the area, if you can make it. If you know people in the area, call them up and let them know that these great folks are going to be speaking there. Again, it's June 23rd and the 24th. Now, James, I want to hone in on you right now because a lot of our supporters are fans of yours. And I said this earlier, I'm not exaggerating. Most times when somebody wants to tell me about a bit of news, the video they are sending me is one of yours. And a lot of times I've seen it already. I mean, so, you know, you certainly have get around and you're certainly well known among the alternative news movement. I always wonder what motivates people. So before we get into the deeper issues, tell our audience more about yourself. How did you get involved in the alternative media and creating the Corbett Report?
Well, actually, I think that my story more or less lines up with Richard's own story, specifically regarding 9/11. Richard, at what point exactly did you start questioning the 9/11 official story?
That wasn't until 2007 when I heard David Ray Griffin talking about Building 7 and the explosive evidence at the Twin Towers on the radio program by Bonnie Faulkner when I was in the Bay Area.
That's right. Yes, I remember hearing that story from you. And the surprising thing about that is that I guess I was a little bit earlier than yourself. I feel quite late to the party, if you want to call it that. But I certainly always felt that I was a bit late coming to this realization, because for me, it was 2006, around the time of the fifth anniversary. And although I didn't directly connect that at the time, I think it's quite evident that there was a lot of information swirling around in the internet space around that time of the fifth anniversary of 9/11 regarding 9/11 truth that I think had a knock-on effect that ultimately shocked me out of my complacency. And the long story short is that I was at that precise time in the fall of 2006, I was moving into a new apartment here in Japan, And the apartment came with an internet connection with it. I didn't have to set anything up, so I didn't have to pay extra for it. So it was the first time in several years that I had had an internet connection in my home. I had been living in various apartments that just didn't have an internet connection, so I would go to internet cafes to access my email and that sort of thing. But now, suddenly, I had an internet connection in my home, and so, hey, why not? I started looking at all of these things that had popped up on the online space in the time that I hadn't been much online, like YouTube and Google Video and things that were around at that time that allowed me access to the types of things that I would have wanted to be watching if I could have controlled television back in my youth. Of course, those of us born pre-internet age will remember there was a time when whatever was on at, 7 o'clock on a Sunday night was what you were going to be watching if you were watching anything on Sunday at 7 p.m. It seems like a strange concept, I suppose, for millennials and people growing up in the age of the internet. But no, there really was a time where you had, when I was a child, it was three stations. We had three stations before we got cable. So there you go. And that was the limits of your mediated reality, unless you went and actually picked up a book. So when I discovered this new internet connection, YouTube, Google Video, suddenly I was immersed in all of this political information. I was always interested in politics and history and philosophy and science and all of these different areas, but had always been limited in sort of the extent to which I'd be able to really get involved in looking at all of this type of information to the extent that I wanted. Now, suddenly, I could look at absolutely anything that I wanted at any time. I just type it in and there it would be. And before long, I would find myself on YouTube or a Google Video, and I would see related videos to the ones that I was watching about politics. I would see related videos to do with 9/11, which was interesting. So I would click on them out of interest. And more often than not at that time, a lot of the things that I was seeing were, quite frankly, ridiculous and quite far-fetched things about flying orbs and things like this, which pretty much fed into my preconceptions at that time that anything to do with 9/11 conspiracy theorizing was just insanity, just lunacy, and there was no serious content to it. But every now and then I would click on something that looked interesting and I would see a clip. And I wish I could remember what clips specifically I was looking at or from what documentaries or what it might have been. But at any rate, there were things in there that caught my attention, talking about various aspects of 9/11 that I hadn't heard before. And Osama bin Laden and the bin Laden family's connections to the Bushes and things like this that I thought sounded a bit silly. But I decided to look into them myself. And it was through that process of starting to look and trying to debunk for myself some of these things that I was finding online, and finding that not only were they not bunk, I could find actual documentation to back them up. Things like the actual documents from Operation Northwoods that have been declassified and released, and things along those lines that really got me to see that there is more to this story than what we've been told. And from that point, it was really just falling further and further down that rabbit hole, if you will, to find out other things about society, about the monetary system and other aspects of things that I had never even thought to question before. So it really was 9/11 for me was kind of that my gateway drug, if you want to put it that way, for me to start exploring this universe more in a more in-depth manner. And so it wasn't very long before the extent to which I had been lied to about such important things, or such important information had been occluded from my attention by the gatekeepers, really, of the corporate media, who decided up until that in the internet age what people watched and listened to and heard and saw. The extent of the discrepancy between this information and that information, which I'd always been told, was so great that I realized that I had to insert myself in there somehow. I had to bring this information to other people. And this being the age of the internet, it wasn't long before I decided, well, I better start a website and why not start a podcast? And that was really the impetus for it. And within a few months, I'd set up the Corbett Report website. So I started this experience in late 2006. By June of 2007, I had my first podcast episode up and I just never looked back. And I've been doing it ever since then, for 10 years now.
This is what I love about this movement. I think this is going to be one of the greatest stories in American history, even world history, because you have a bunch of ordinary people in their various situations coming across information. In many cases, in very much the same way, your story sounds very similar to mine, and taking it upon themselves to step up and do the right thing and get this information out there. And I know we're having an impact on society and on what happens in this world affecting the public consciousness. You know, you made me nostalgic for the old days by talking about the three channels. I remember those days. It was like 1 o'clock, the TV went off, and it was like the whole world was asleep. Nobody even believed me that Fox existed. I actually discovered it by tuning the bottom dial on the television set. And I must have gotten my training back then for being a 9/11 truth person, because nobody believed me this other network existed until somebody with authority stepped into the room and said, oh, yeah, I guess there is something there. Yeah, I've been saying it for 2 months, so that prepared me for my role now. But I was looking at your website earlier, and you have a post with a title that I couldn't agree with more. It says, only 9/11 truth can smash the 9/11 lies. And this is a point I've been trying to get across every single week when I do this show. But I want to hear it from your take. Can you elaborate on that sentiment?
Well, I think the core idea here is that 9/11, of course, isn't simply about 9/11, that September 11th is not a single day in history that can be isolated from the rest of history and that is only viewable as a series of events that took place on that morning. Of course, September 11th has a much deeper history in events that preceded September 11th by years and decades. And of course, we've seen the effects of what happened on that day spooling out before us for the proceeding 16 years. So we know that September 11th is kind of a moment in which a lot of these threads connect, but it is only that, it's only one moment. And so much of the world that we now live in, and so many of the things that I think people are genuinely and for good reason concerned about right now, not only with regards to their sense of safety and security in an age of terror, but perhaps more importantly, by what has occurred on the back of that sense of insecurity, which is to say the rise of more and more restrictions and control in the form of police state internally and domestically in the United States and other countries. And also, of course, the various wars that have been waged around the world on the back of the invocation of 9/11. And of course, the Iraq War, for example, we're endlessly told was not about 9/11. Although at the time, of course, 9/11 was constantly evoked as one of the reasons why we have to go into Iraq, why we have to take down Saddam, because that type of thing. It was just it was never an A, therefore B. It was more like, here's A, here's B. We'll let people do the math. And it was always 9/11 that was used as the justification. And even to this day, I think 9/11 is still one of those touchstones. So it isn't, for me, it isn't just a fixation on a particular, one particular thing that is clearly and demonstrably not the way it's been told. That in and of itself is certainly interesting and motivating for people who are concerned about truth. But I think because of the ramifications that September 11th has had in shaping almost every conceivable aspect of our political reality these days, it has to be confronted in order to truly understand what is happening and what the best way to proceed forward is. Because if we don't understand the basis of this so-called age of the war on terror, then how on earth can we possibly resolve this in a way that doesn't ultimately play into the hands of whoever actually perpetrated those crimes?
You know, when I had my old news website, I used to keep track of this every year, as how the president, first Bush and then Obama, would extend the state of emergency declared on September 11th every single year. And while you were talking, I just Googled it again because I haven't kept track of it for a number of years. And right there, September of 2016, Obama extends the state of emergency. It's like 9/11 never ended, not just on paper from when the president signs that extension, but in the minds of the American public too. Everything that has been pushed on us in these years has had 9/11 as a justification for it. So I know that's why we're all in this fight, all the activists that listen to this show. Richard, can you elaborate your own view on that? Only 9/11 truth can smash the 9/11 lies?
Yeah, it's quite a topic. Our geopolitical framework today was shaped largely by 9/11. We invaded two countries, killed over 2 million people. Our freedom was traded for security. Any of us can be arrested, held without a trial, without a right to a jury or a lawyer. We can be detained indefinitely. We can even be tortured and even assassinated as American citizens. This is not what our forefathers fought for. We're in a $4.5 trillion global war on terror. Now, all of that goes back to 9/11/2001, and on which two planes brought down three high-rises. And this was fraudulently foisted on the American people and the people of the world in order to reshape the public consciousness, put us in a state of fear, of shock and awe. And so only the truth about what really happened there can expose all of this, pull the carpet out from underneath the whole sham going all the way back to 9/11. And of course, as James indicated, this goes way back before 9/11. And so that's why I agree with James that only the 9/11 truth can smash the 9/11 lies and restore our faith in our government, our economy, our reputation in the world. These are huge changes that are unlikely to come about absent a catalyzing and catastrophic event such as the exposure of the truth about 9/11 to the American people. And that's what Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth is dedicated to. Our mission is to bring the evidence to the people so that they can wake up and realize that they have been scammed on a huge order, that these three towers, the World Trade Center Building 7, a 47-story skyscraper that collapses on the afternoon of 9/11, about 7 hours after the Twin Towers came down, this building drops like a rock suddenly, straight down, uniformly, symmetrically, into its own footprint in under 7 seconds at free fall acceleration. Now, this does not happen by a few small scattered office fires. And yet that is exactly what the official story is. And nobody buys it once they see the evidence. But most architects and most engineers are completely unaware of the third worst structural failure in modern history, Building 7. So we show it to them at the conventions that we go to. They drop their jaws. They say, you mean our government and the AIA, American Institute of Architects, by the way, supports the theory that this building dropped like that due to normal office fires? And I say, yep. And they say, where do I sign up? And so that's why we have 2,800 architects and engineers now calling for a new investigation of the destruction of all three of these towers. And the evidence at the Twin Towers is actually even more compelling. So I look forward to sharing this at the Red Pill Expo as well, this evidence.
Now, James, for years, we've been at this a long time, a lot of us, you included, and so you always hear this term mass awakening, all this talk about when will it happen, when will we reach critical mass. Do you feel that that's happened to any extent now, and if so, how do you feel about how it's manifested in recent world events?
I think it's demonstrable. I think there are things that you can point to that show that there is a profound shift that's taken place in the narrative discourse that goes along or surrounds these types of events, even in the popular mainstream press. And that, for example, I noticed that in 2013, in the immediate wake of the Boston Marathon bombing, there was a headline on Yahoo News, of all places, to the effect, I don't remember the exact headline, but it was something to the effect of, was Boston, the Boston Marathon bombing, a false flag event? And just the fact that mainstream news headlines now include the lexicology of this, that false flag terror and things of that, the fact that this is now not only a concept that people can get their heads around, can even understand, but that it is commonly used and to the point where people can recognize and understand what is being referred to in a headline like that, is itself a true, I suppose, achievement, if you want to look at it in that way. It truly does represent something different, because 10 years ago, when I was starting out with this, the first thing that anyone would ask when confronted by this this type of idea for the first time is, well, why would the government do that to themselves? It was such an unthinkable concept, false flag terrorism in general, and people did not know any of the history about it, to the point where they couldn't even understand the concept that was being put in front of them. Now, as I say, it's demonstrable. It's actually entered the discourse. It's in the vernacular. People know at least what is being referred to when you talk about the concept of false flag terrorism. And most people have at least heard about it and heard of some of the examples that are cited throughout history of this type of phenomenon. So that is a not just an achievement, that's something that you can put your finger on, that you can point to, that you can show that things have changed over the course of this past decade. But what does that ultimately mean? Does that mean that there has been a mass awakening and we are now all aware of how this works? Well, not necessarily. Of course, it does mean that people are at least familiar with the concept, but it doesn't mean that they embrace it. If anything, it means that those people who have really not looked at the evidence that Richard's talking about, have not confronted that evidence and have not confronted the real meaning of what that shows about what did occur on September 11th and what did not occur, have at this point probably retreated even further into their protective cognitive shell, whereby they recognize that term of false flag terrorism as quote unquote conspiracy theory that must not be discussed in polite conversation. So, in, to a certain extent, even bringing it out in the open and getting it discussed like that isn't necessarily an indicator that it's going to have the knock-on political effect. And then, of course, the question of how this actually gets effectuated in the real world, in the realm of politics or the judicial system or whatever way that we can think of that will have an actual effect on shaping policy and the things that are going on from this point forward, that's an entirely different conversation. And I'm afraid I'm fairly pessimistic as to where we've gotten in the past 16 years on that front, which is why I also stress, although of course the goal of the 9/11 truth movement has to be 9/11 justice, and we have to continue to strive for bringing justice to the perpetrators of these attacks. But I think we also need, as a second part of that mission, to win the in the court of public opinion, the trial of the 9/11 perpetrators, and to show that what we've been told about September 11th is a demonstrable lie, to the point that it undermines people's faith in the types of people who would perpetrate that myth on the public. And to that extent, again, I think there has been significant achievement in the past decade. With people now, I believe the latest figure, something like 12% or 11% of the public actually approves of Congress and what they're doing. Something like 8 or 9% actually say that they trust mainstream news headlines. I mean, again, this type of breakdown in faith in these institutions that help to perpetrate the 9/11 lie can be a significant achievement, a good thing. But again, it depends on how that plays out and how that can be diverted and how the alternative media and people bringing alternative information can be used as part of the system that ultimately props up the establishment. And there are many layers to that. So it's not an unproblematic story, a narrative of victory and achievement. But I think there are things that have changed in the past decade. And I think we need to find ways to leverage those points of change and the change in the public consciousness that has occurred as a result of them into getting true fundamental change in the way that 9/11 is used as that be-all, catch-all justification for anything that the establishment wants to do.
That's so funny you mention about how people initially think about this information. I think that we have really, as a movement, all total, alternative media, have influenced the public to be more distrustful of institutions, like you were saying. So, for instance, if we wake up a congressman secretly, he may not even acknowledge it, but we show him Building 7 falling, he thinks, oh my god, yeah, I guess there might be something to this, but he doesn't say it. In the future, some legislation might come up to impose more restrictions on our civil liberties, maybe something having to do with some other attack or starting another war, and he may be more skeptical of that legislation moving forward. So we have a bunch of small victories under our belt, but you don't ever see big, massive action towards something that will be more concrete. And I thought this would be easy when I first started. I was really naive. I thought I would just have to wake up some people on MySpace and they would see this and be horrified and write their congressman. And there you go. It's over in 5 months. Obviously, it's not been like that. What do you think is the biggest obstacle in the minds of the public to getting these facts to cement in their heads and motivating the masses to demand justice?
I think that a significant part of the problem is the way that the establishment media, which I think we understand at this point, does work as a type of mouthpiece for what the government and the authorities and institutions like that ultimately want us to believe, as demonstrated by their perpetuation of the 9/11 lie. The way that that establishment media can get people to believe that they are in the minority, that they are an insignificant little fringe on the outside of this debate. And they are very effective, they have been in the past at any rate, very effective in getting people to believe that because they control the media that is consumed by the vast majority of people most of their day, or at least they have been until this age of the internet. And so you can feel very small and insignificant and what can I possibly do? But there are whenever there is a free and fair playing field for information to compete for the minds of the public, I think it's shown time and time and time again that there is much, much greater receptivity to these ideas amongst the general public than will ever be told to you on the 6 o'clock news broadcast. For example, I was talking earlier about the early days of Google Video and YouTube back a decade ago, and I thought it was particularly telling that back when I first started going through this process and looking at these videos, Google Video, for example, had a daily top 10 videos list. And on that top 10 videos, especially in late 2006 when I started, it was almost always dominated by what we would consider truth-related documentaries, specifically about September 11th, about false flag terrorism, about the monetary paradigm, other things in that wheelhouse. It was usually, there was at least 3 or 4, often 7 or 8 or 9 videos in that top 10 related to those subjects, and often with a 9/11 truth-related documentary or video being the number one video of the day. That was interesting, and that was probably part of what ultimately got me to the point where I started questioning it, because it was prompting me to click on these videos and check out what are people interested in. And so it was not very long. It was really only a few months after the point at which I started noticing this, that they started to change the algorithm with regards to that top 10 so that it was more often cat videos or those kinds of silly viral videos that we now associate more with the internet that would be in the top 10. Then they ultimately shifted the top 10 out of this prominent position on the front page and a sidebar, off into a kind of place you'd have to click on in order to even see. And then they ultimately scrapped the top 10 altogether. And then they scrapped Google Video altogether and just shifted on everyone onto YouTube. But YouTube at that point still had a front page that everybody could see. And so there were times, at least a couple of times that I can remember, that a video of mine got onto the front page of YouTube back when there was a single front page of YouTube. And instantly, overnight, I would get hundreds of thousands of views on a video. And people who had never heard of me or seen my work before would suddenly be exposed to myself and my channel. That doesn't happen anymore because YouTube ultimately, of course, got rid of their front page. So now it's always tailored recommendations tailored for you. So people who are interested in things like 9/11 truth will probably come across a Corbett Report video at some point. But people who are not interested probably will never come across a Corbett Report video unless they are specifically searching for it. And so we see ways in which these types of systems themselves can be tailored to make it less and less likely that people will come across this information. And I think we see that in a number of different fronts, not just in the YouTube, Google universe, but in other fronts as well. Again, to make people feel like this information is fringe, that it's only seen by certain types of people, that there's only a little bit of it out there, and you have to kind of be in those circles to find this information. But another prime example of this idea that this really is more popular than people believe is C-SPAN. I did an episode of my podcast several years ago now called, I believe, Globalists Hate C-SPAN was the name of the podcast episode, where I just took a bunch of different clips from politicians and people who had been involved in government and NIST and other institutions who had appeared on C-SPAN programs over the years. And the callers, inevitably, there would be numerous callers grilling them about 9/11, about the demolition of World Trade Center Building 7, about these types of incidents. And they would be dismissive after the first couple of callers on those subjects. Oh, we've got the loons calling in today. But after the fourth, fifth, sixth time somebody brings this information up, it's becoming quite obvious to them. And you can see it visibly in their faces if you watch the C-SPAN clips. Oh, this is actually something people care about. And I think it's in moments like that that we can see that this is actually much more widespread than people believe. It's just because generally those types of open fora are not available for people to express their opinions. So it gets shunted off. But I think there have been successes when it comes to putting these types of ideas and the opposition to the policies that are backed on the 9/11, based on these 9/11 lies, into reality. In times like in 2013, when the Obama administration and the UK government were thinking about launching a military action in Syria, and we had that hands-off Syria protest movement, people were flooding the streets, people were calling their congressmen. There was a lot of activity regarding specifically, we do not want another entanglement in the Middle East. We do not want to see more military action in Syria. This is not what the people want. And it was diverted, ultimately. It didn't go ahead. It was voted down in the UK Parliament, and Obama did not go ahead at that time with the military intervention. I think there are moments like that where we at least get a glimpse of what this can be if people come together and really coordinate on at least on specific policy agendas. Ones that are too broad-based will tend to dissipate, but on specific things that can be leveraged, I think there still is the chance to make it known that this movement and these ideas are not fringe. They are central to the political debate that is going on, or they should be in any universe that really reflected what people are thinking and what they really believe on these issues.
Now, we talk about a new investigation all the time and what it'll look like. We're going to start with Richard and then James. Richard, do you think the government can investigate itself?
Well, I don't presume that the government performed 9/11, first of all. The government is a huge operation full of patriots and people who are corrupt as well. Congress itself, there's some evidence that many, perhaps most, have been corrupted in one way or another, but I don't believe that they're responsible for doing 9/11. So, in a sense, I do believe that that Congress can be forced through political willpower, an uprising, if you will, of the people once they become educated and informed about the evidence at the World Trade Center, particularly, but all of 9/11 events, that they can force their representatives to act, or they will vote them out of office. That will happen eventually. As James mentioned, we're looking at a critical mass that's required. Now, we don't know how close we are to that point. We have evidence that there are a whole lot more people aware of the evidence, twice as many people as there were 5 years ago and then 10 years ago. So there's an acceleration in the quantities of people aware. So we're educating the public en masse through radio programs such as this, and to the academic and professional architects and engineers who are in a position to where once they become aware of the evidence, they clearly see, and most of them end up supporting us in one way or another, not yet with the level that we need to turn this thing around. So we're pushing a big rock up a big hill is what we're doing, and we just don't know where the ridge is because the rock is in the way. So we're doing what we have to do, and we're getting from our members, we're in the middle of an annual membership drive right now, as a matter of fact, and I encourage all of our listeners to become a member of 8/11 Truth for as little as $2.50 a month, $7.50 a month, $25 a month, whatever your ability to help us, wherever that is. So please do that. But
What kind of an investigation are we looking for? We're looking for one that looks at all of this evidence, one that uses the scientific method relative to evaluating it, one that offers immunity to bring forth witnesses so that we can get the truth told and takes that testimony under oath. That is the kind of investigation we're looking for. Can we get it in Congress? I don't know. Certainly not yet. Are there incorruptible bodies internationally? Maybe. I hope so.
Now, I'm going to ask James the same question, but just to clarify, of course, when I'm saying government, I don't mean every single person in it, but we have clear evidence of fraud, at least in the NIST report, where they know that there's problems with their analysis, omitted structural features, and they refuse to do anything about it. So certainly we need a government to investigate itself there in that case. But James, do you think we can get the government to investigate itself, particularly with 9/11?
Well, let me start by saying that I think that the work that groups like AE 9/11 Truth and others do in trying to get this process going is extremely valuable. And I would never try to discourage anyone from engaging in that, because at what is possible, I think what is really possible, of course, we would love, as I say, to see the a grand jury with real subpoena powers and real power to imprison people who are found guilty of having conspired in the attacks of 9/11. That has to be the goal, ultimately, justice for the perpetrators of these attacks. But even a congressional investigation that was limited in its scope and ability could still have extremely important effects. For example, we could look back to the 1970s, and in the wake of Watergate, we saw the Church Committee hearings, which, however controlled the release of information from those hearings may have been, at any rate, there are still valuable pieces of information that came out as a result of those hearings that we can point to today to show people instances of how the intelligence agencies manipulate public opinion and, for example, Operation Mockingbird and the extent of CIA control over the media and the heart attack gun and other things that came out as a result, direct result of those types of that type of congressional investigation. So that can occur. It has occurred in the past. I think it's something that we should be trying to press for in every way that we can. Again, even if it doesn't result in convictions for the perpetrators of the attacks, it can still have valuable effects. Having said that, I'm rather pessimistic about the possibility of that, especially now that we are now 16 years out from the events. And although, of course, as we've said, 9/11 is the groundwork upon which these last 16 years have been built, it is now more seen as that distant base groundwork that doesn't even have to be explained anymore. People will just say terror, and the people who live through 9/11 will think 9/11 in their minds. It doesn't even have to be explicitly called for. So the political impetus of 9/11 is fading the further out from the event that we get. But I would say that, again, I think the most important part of this is in the very practical sense of what can be done and what can be achieved, we have to, at the very least, break the tool of false flag terror and break it in the face of those who would use it against the public to manipulate them into wars of aggression. And as I say, there are indications that that is already happening. Even the idea of false flag terrorism, which was unthinkable and unrecognizable to most people a decade ago, is part of the popular discourse today. That is an achievement insofar as at least people are thinking about this possibility, questioning it. Even Yahoo News has to put up a headline: was Boston bombing a false flag event? Of course, they came to the conclusion that, of course, it was not. But we would expect nothing less from Yahoo News. But at any rate, they have to ask the question. They have to at least address the question at this point. And that is a significant achievement, because if they cannot perpetrate something like 9/11 again without the vast majority of people questioning, well, how do we know what happened? Is that what really happened? And where did we get this information? And we should take a closer look at this. This seems odd. the fact that there are so many more people now who are willing and able to do that, because again, now we are much significantly more advanced with our online communications technologies than we were 16 years ago. I think there is a real chance that the efficacy of a tool like false flag terrorism to be perpetrated and used against the public is decreasing the more advanced our ability to communicate this information to others is. So I think that has to be a key part of the goal. And to some extent, I wouldn't want our imagination of what can result from the 9/11 truth movement to be limited by the government's conception of what a movement, a political movement, must look like and the steps that it must follow. And there must be a congressional investigation that comes to some sort of formal government ruling that, yes, 9/11 was in some extent engineered or allowed by the U.S. government or whatever they come to. I don't think we have to put ourselves in that framework to understand what success for the 9/11 truth movement could be.
That's right. We have so many successes, small ones, all the time in terms of getting the information out there, different ways to bring it to the public. You know, you see that it's kind of bleeding into the culture. So I'm totally optimistic. I think anything is possible if people put their minds to it, if people work hard enough. I think this is going to be the greatest story ever told in American history at some point. And we've overcome some very dark things in this country. I mean, at one point we had slavery in this country. That took a long time to overcome that and free people. So, you know, this is just like that. And I think this will be actually something that will be looked upon. The people in the 9/11 truth movement, alternative media movement, will be looked upon as real patriots in about 100 years or so, but even sooner than that, when they look back and see what a lot of the people like yourself and Richard have done. We got a lot of activists who listen to the show, people who don't just listen to the information, they go out and do something about it. So, James, in our last few minutes here, what advice would you give to them? What can they do better? Should they just keep on doing what they've been doing? Is there something they should be doing more of? What would you say that people should do with this information that you haven't seen done so far?
Well, actually, I think the idea that of what we haven't seen so far or what hasn't been done often or done well is the thing to stress about this. Of course, me being me and me being who I am and what I've become over the past decade of becoming a professional podcaster, if there is such a thing, I am doing this for a living, obviously influences my understanding of what is achievable. And so my inclination would be to say, well, everyone else should go out there and do something similar, start a website or start a podcast. But of course, realistically, this is really not for everyone. Not very many people are interested in that form of communication or have the requisite ability or skills or equipment or even the interest in doing something like that. And I think that's the point. It has to be motivated by your interest. Every single person on this planet has things that are interesting and motivating to them, skills that they have that other people lack. And the skills that I lack that other people have can be extremely effective in communicating this information in different ways to people that I'll never be able to reach. One glaring example would be my complete and total inability with the visual artistic medium. I cannot paint, I cannot sculpt, I cannot do anything visually like that. And I admire that ability and I admire the work of others, but I certainly can't do that. So people who are able to take this type of information and put it into an image of some sort, that is extremely effective in communicating. As we've seen with the rise of meme culture on the internet, you don't even have to personally be visually artistic yourself to just be able to encapsulate ideas down to a funny or interesting image that gets information through to people that way. That can be one way to communicate with others. There are people who are musically inclined, who are able to put this type of these thoughts, these ideas, encapsulate them in music or in song. There are, again, whatever people are interested in and whatever ways they have of communicating information to other people are ways that should be tapped into. So I don't want to be sitting here on a pedestal telling people what they should do. I'd rather people discover that. And I think the people who are truly motivated, who truly feel that discrepancy I was talking about between what they've been told and what they can prove for themselves, the people who truly feel that will find a way to use their skills. And that's what I like to see. People who are just authentically expressing themselves, because people can tell when you're putting on an act or when you're not being yourself, when you're not, when you're trying to do something just because you're copying what someone else is doing, versus what when you're doing something that really, really oozes out of your very soul. And I think people respond to that. So I'm not going to tell people what to do. I'm just going to say, do that thing it is that you can do in order to pass this information on to other people. And maybe that's just water cooler conversation with people in your office or whatever it is, making a conscious decision that I'm not going to shut up when people are talking about these issues. I'm going to put my point of view in there as well. And you never know what effect that will have in opening other people's minds or discovering other people who are actually on thinking along the same lines as you, who were always too afraid to speak up themselves. So even the smallest type of decision can actually have huge real world ramifications that you could never dream of. And I'm living, breathing proof of that, because when I started the Corbett Report 10 years ago, in my wildest imagination, I never would have imagined it would become what it has become and has reached millions of people around the world. It is a mind-boggling concept for me, and it never would have happened if I hadn't just decided I've got to do something. And that's ultimately it. Just do that thing that it is that you can do, and do it as much as you can. And that is really the key to achieving success in this.
Yeah, I love it, because that's what I've been saying for years too. I mean, everyone's born with a talent. Use it for good. As long as you are speaking, as long as you are metaphorically punching, you are fighting back, and you'll land that blow that'll be the knockout punch at some point, or at least contribute to the overall team that's trying to bring this monster down. These guys are going to be speaking again at the Red Pill Expo that is on June the 23rd and the 24th in Bozeman, Montana. Check it out, redpillexpo.org. I want to thank Richard Gage, James Corbett for coming on 9/11 Freefall.
Thanks so much, Andy.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
This program is on every Thursday night on No Lies Radio at 10 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Pacific. You can also keep track of the archives by going to 911freefall.com. This is Andy Steele saying have a great week and good luck.